you become more successful when you have relationships because you're able to navigate those conversations with ease and also influence people within the organization.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Carolina Aponte from the Breaking Even Better podcast, so kind of a CFO superstar. We're here to talk about, you know, I've asked many people on this podcast, you know, what is your most proud career moment? And I've had many great responses, but I think Carolina has my favorite. When I asked Carolina, I said, what's your proudest moment? She talked about the 10 businesses she helped get over a million, which I thought is emblematic of Carolina's spirit. We're going to hear a story today about someone who came to America, prototypical living the American dream, come to America empty-handed and has risen to the heights of a very prestigious award, which I'm going to talk about later on, and also built a fractional CFO accountancy business that many people should be envious of. So if you want to hear about this story and how this could happen for you, Carolina is very generous in providing her experience here for us all to learn from. So Carolina, welcome to the show. Maybe you can kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Well, first of all, thank you, James, for the invitation. And I love having a conversation. It is my nature to be talkative. So anytime I have an opportunity to do it, I sign up for it.
Great.
So maybe something that people don't know about me is that I arrived in the United States at the age of 20 with no high school degree.
Wow. Okay. So let's pause right there. Where did you come from? And what, if you don't mind me asking, most people have their high school degree by 20. So what happened that you weren't able to get yours?
Right. So the kind of a long story, but I'm from Venezuela and a small island in Venezuela called Margarita. When I was a child, my parents owned a business that afforded them the opportunity for us to come to the United States. At 13, I came to the United States to learn English, go to school. And during that time, their business went bankrupt. And so we had to go back to Venezuela. And the challenge for me as somebody who was a teenager, you know, going from one country to another and then going back to the country where kids had already grown, build their relationships and all of that, I felt I was an outsider now. And as a teenager, I was also rebellious. And so instead of going back to school and getting my high school degree, I went to work. I became a tour guide because I spoke English. And instead of going to school, I just became a tour guide because I wanted to make money so I could come back to the United States.
Very good. So I thought for a second there, you're going to tell me you joined a circus, but you went to work. So yeah.
I am the circus, James.
Okay. So I see already, you know, money is in, you know, is it in your life? If you like, you are business orientated, let's call it that way. I guess largely tips is a large part of that business. What did you learn from that first job that you still kind of are very thankful for that you maybe still use today?
Oh my gosh, so many things. I think one of the first things I learned was to improvise. And as a business owner, that's something that you have to do constantly. So yeah. I think that was the first thing, because when something wasn't going right during the tour, or some human thing happened, I had to step in very young and kind of improvise and make things better for the whole group. I think that's one of the lessons. And I think the second one was about connections, building relationships. I became, you know, just very savvy in being friendly to the restaurants and to the shops and to the places where I was going to bring the tourists, so that they could be treated, you know, a great experience, because in turn, that would help my tips.
Right. Okay. Very good. And I'm always curious about that. Was there any kickback from the restaurants you bring them to?
Yes, there are kickbacks.
Oh, okay. Tell me the secrets. Yeah. I'm always suspicious of this when I go abroad. So you put your own little tariff on the tourists, which before it was a thing.
It was all worth it, though. I was giving them a good time.
Yeah. Very, very good. All right. So you did that. And then did you come to the US by yourself or back with your family? Right. Tell me about that. So you arrived. What caused you to move, to want to move?
Well, like I mentioned, I felt like an outsider in my own country, and I was young. And also, I quickly realized that it was the machismo culture in my country was just very predominant. And I felt like I wasn't never really going to reach success or like the independence. I wouldn't call it success at that time, but I would call it independence, financial independence. And so having been in the United States and seeing how things work out in the United States, I was like, well, that's where I need to be, because that's where I'll be able to be financially independent, not here. And so that was the driving force into becoming an immigrant and moving to the United States, even if I didn't have a high school degree. But I just felt like I had internal tools that I could use build myself up.
So what were your tools? What were these? What made you? Well, okay, you had no choice for a start. That's a great one, right? So that's one thing that immigrants have as an advantage. There's no safety net, no nothing. So, yeah. So how'd you get started?
So resilience, right? You just become resilient and you learn to adapt. Hmm. So I'm a very adaptable individual. I don't prescribe to the typical society ideas that you have to have this, you know, path and you have to live in this place and you have to have this thing in order to be considered something. I never really care about any of that. I just wanted to have independence. So how I started is I, you know, came to Miami at the time, and I, through connections, because I went to a party and I met somebody, and I told that person, hey, I'm looking for a job. And they're like, oh, you're going to stay. And I said, yeah, I'm going to stay. I need a job. I need to start making money. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, actually, my roommate works for a law firm and they're looking for a bilingual receptionist.
Nice. Okay, perfect.
And I was like, well, I'm it.
Right. Okay. Given the choice of nothing or that or whatever it was. Yeah. Okay. You got into that office environment. Now, I want to ask you about resilience. Now, maybe because it's a very important property. Can you think of a time that, you know, resilience really paid off for you? Where did you learn you had this resilience? Like, what's the worst thing you had to work through and you just did anyway?
Oh, gosh. Well, supporting myself as a single individual woman, you know, living on her own, I wasn't making enough money as a receptionist to support myself.
Right.
Back in those days, the pay was very low, and especially because I didn't have the education. I was just a receptionist. So I had to get a second job. So I would leave the law office and go at night and work somewhere else. And part of that was trying to find things that I could do, but still keep my day job. Mm-hmm. And that was challenging. So I worked in retail, I worked in restaurants, I worked like in all of this different, but I never really found that it was, I guess, mentally challenging for me. It was just like, just to generate money.
Yeah.
And I was even delivering back in the day. There were yellow pages, which were very big, you know, books that had all the phone numbers and addresses. And I was even delivering those. And you can see me because I'm sitting down, but I'm only 5 feet tall. So very small, very petite. And back then I was very skinny. And I was carrying this big yellow pages, you know, up the stairs and down the stairs and delivering that, you know, so I could make additional money. And at some point, my sister, she's older than I, she also moved to Miami and she got married and she had a baby. During this period of time, she was living her life, I was living mine. But her husband also had multiple jobs, but he got sick. And one of the jobs was delivering newspaper route at 5 o'clock in the morning. And my sister had a newborn. So I stepped in and I said, I'll do it. Because if he didn't do it, he was going to lose the route. So now I had three jobs.
Yeah. It's interesting. Right now, there's a lot of business advice online. You know, it's all over the place. There's one guy I like, Alex Hormozi, and he really focuses on the effort is the algorithm, more or less. Like, so everyone's looking for the hack or the, you know, the clever move or the whatever. Sometimes it's just that sense of just get it done, like do what an overwhelming effort, like just a big army up the middle, just get it done. And that's knowing you have that in you. It's very freeing, I think, because you know you're capable of it. Like if you, I'm sure it's been tough times where you thought back and said, well, I'm not getting up at 5 a.m. to deliver a paper and I'm not doing this. So actually this is easy, whatever this is, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I you know, I have daughters. So whenever they complain about something, I'm like, listen, you don't know what you're talking about.
All right. Well, listen, let's get on to some accountancy topics and bookkeeping and finance topics here. You had a toe in the water into accounts. Was this in the law firm you got a chance to go into the accounts department as a controller first, or what was the first step?
No, so the first thing was that during that period of time at the law firm, I learned how to do bookkeeping on the green ledgers. So this was prior to computers, prior to QuickBooks. I volunteered to do this and I fell in love with it because it gave me a sense of completion that I would start the month reconciled and have an end. And so at that moment, it just sparked that that's the career that I wanted to then pursue. Because remember, I was still not, you know, I hadn't gone to school or anything. So that opportunity to learn how to do bookkeeping gave me the, like the idea of, okay, I can pursue a career in accounting. How do I do it? Well, I was fortunate to have a mentor within the organization, and she encouraged me to get my GED and to go to school at night. And I was like, yeah, but like I have a job at night because I can't afford. And she offered to pay for my first semester.
Very interesting. Okay. And I'm interested in this controller role and specifically in this, because this is, you know, you did some entry level. What's different than the clerk level, I guess, is just the, doing the entries and then.
Well, yeah. So I started as an accounts payable clerk, basically, you know, posting bills. And this was for a software company. And I started doing that job very end, low entry. I was fast. I was I was good at the job. And then I got another promotion. And then I got another promotion. I was learning on the job. That was the best school I ever had. And so as I was learning, I was also going to school. And then I was like, okay, I can do more. And then I became the controller for this company.
So this controller role, I'm really interested in. So let's do the basics. Treat me like an idiot, if you can imagine that for a second, right? So tell me what a controller does, for starters.
Well, the controller makes sure that the business is following the generally accepted practices, the GAAP, make sure that there are checks and balances and that people are doing what they're supposed to do, that you can account the money for the money, that things are happening how they're supposed to happen, and that the business is achieving the financial goals they set up by running reports, by, you know, training the team, by putting all those rules in place.
Okay. So break that down. Like, is that broken into AP and AR, or what are the big chunks of it?
Right. So as a controller, I had an accounts payable team. I had an accounts receivable team. And then I had like the support for me to be able to like put it all together, right? So all of these different individuals reported directly to me, and I reported to the owner at the time of the company.
Okay. So, and then those roles, let's say on the AP side, accounts payable, is that just making sure that you've received things before you pay them, or what's the day-to-day?
Yeah,
so
the bills would come in. Back in the day, it was in the mail. Then there was not so much the emails. They would come in the mail. Those bills from the vendors, had to be verified that it was indeed something that we bought or that we needed to pay. So there was a process for that. And then once that was verified that if there was a purchase order, that it was connected to that bill, did the quantities, because the company was a software company, but we had a hardware division. So we were buying motherboards and hard drives and all of that stuff. So there was a process that the accounts payable department needed to go through to verify that those bills indeed belong to us and that we owe that money. And then once that happened, they would enter them in the system and we would then get, I would get an accounts payable aging report to see what did we owe so that we can compare that to the cash flow and see, okay, what are we approving to be paid?
Oh, interesting. So did you use purchase orders in that role or was it just based on invoice? You did as well. Okay. So you could have some visibility of what was coming down the line and this where it comes. And how much of that role is, you know, some industries are different. Some of them, like, let's just pick a random one like construction. It's like quite a full contact experience, like it's notorious for everyone chasing everyone, no one paying everyone on time. Like it's kind of, you know, and you need to be quite, you need to be quite sharp and maybe a little bit sharp elbows to succeed. Is that true in the software business you're in or?
I think the software business is very different because your revenue is truly more so on the service side. So it just, you have a better cash flow. Let's just call it what it is. So there's less, you know, expenses to, you know, you have the buffer because I think the construction world is different because they do have a struggle with their cash flow because they have, you know, they can have multiple projects. They're upfronting some of the cost and they're not getting paid by their, you know, by their clients on time or in the same schedule that they're paying all these vendors, especially the labor side, right? So there's that, you know, the kind of disconnect of timing that doesn't happen in the software industry.
So the controller position, now I think the controller is really the unsung hero style thing because like the influence on profitability and even survival that a controller has, arguably maybe most influential, maybe you could say you're a top sales guy, but after that, you know, maybe not even the controller really can be the difference between life and death. So what makes an awesome controller? Like when you're hiring now with your team or expanding your team, what sort of attributes do you look from for someone like, oh, that person's going to be a great controller? And I can tell because...
Yeah, I think it's the ability to see the big picture and be able to build relationships with the team members because you got to have the ability to have conversations about this is not the right time. You're going to have to let go of some people or you're going to have to, you know, like all of those difficult conversations, that's what a controller has to have. It is, you become more successful when you have relationships because you're able to navigate those conversations with ease and also influence people within the organization.
Okay. So when you say have had conversations, so I can see that, you know, hiring and firing, that's tough. I guess the controller just does sort of administer that. Maybe gets the, you know, the dirty work in a way, like if someone else makes a decision and then they have to sort of explain the benefits and all the things and all the, how about for, how else do they need to be charged? Like with dealing with vendors, do they need to be?
Dealing with vendors and sometimes even with clients, because even though clients, you know, it's typically handled by the sales and, you know, and marketing areas. Sometimes as a controller, you have to have the conversation of what, like if there's an aging with the, you know, the payment of their invoices. And the salespeople feel like if they push too hard, they may damage their relationship.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So here comes a controller and the controller is able to have a serious, but, you know, meaningful conversation about the relevance of not getting those bills paid or what are our next steps? Can we make a payment plan? What are the things that we need to do in order to rectify whatever is going on? So those kinds of conversations, you know, a controller can have.
Okay. So Let me ask a question for a friend, Carolina. So let's say you have a hypothetical software business and they're doing well, but you know, the profits never really seem to be what they, you know, the budget said that would be, you know, for some reason we start off at the, my friend starts off at the beginning, the start of the year, you know, nice clean spreadsheet saying what we're going to take out at the end. Q1 comes and you know what, actually, you know, we decided to do this other thing and then we did this thing and we started with something else, you know, and then, so can a controller solve that problem for a business owner? In other words, can a controller really, is it possible for them, or if they are a good one, can they make the budget happen the way it's supposed to? Or is it always just going to be the CEO is going to do what he wants to do and that's it?
That part.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
I mean, again, the controller can recommend and can influence,
right.
But ultimately the CEO is, it's going to make the decision they have to make. Now, what is interesting is when the controller has a good relationship with the CEO, then they're able to have a real conversation,
right,
and
right.
Say, James, here's the real deal.
Okay.
And here's what I'm going to need you to do so that we can actually make that happen.
Yeah, very good. Okay, let me ask a bit about the, you know, you beamed with pride when I asked you about your customers that you helped build into seven-figure businesses. Tell me a little bit about your favorites. I know you're not supposed to have favorites, but like, which stories have been most stick to mind for you?
Absolutely. I think some of them have been, you know, minority-owned businesses, women who have decided to step into the CEO role and they've had this great idea and product or service, and they have, you know, accepted my advice and my strategic planning and me holding them accountable to it.
Okay.
And then we reach it, you know, the revenue gets to over $1 million and I get to have the conversation and let them know what they have achieved, because we don't always as business owners get, you know, that pat in the back because we're tagged, you're it, right? But when I have the opportunity to start a meeting saying you're a millionaire,
yeah,
and just let that sit in. That is a transformative message to give to somebody who came from nothing and who has achieved great things.
I love it. I ran a mastermind for grant managers 2 weeks ago, and those guys have a tough job. Huh? Like, they're writing grants on one side, they're trying to administer them on the other side. You know, if someone buys a bus ticket on the wrong credit card and suddenly there's chaos, really hard. And I asked, well, why do you, to be honest, sounds like a shitty job. Like, you know, like you've got all this, and I got a beautiful answer, which was just, you know what? I go down to our project, I walk around, I see the impact we're having, and then that fills me up and I come back and then I get stuck back in, you know, which I thought was a beautiful, beautiful response. So, okay. So now let me try to shine a light on how far you've come, Carolina, from you weren't a street hustler and, you know, and tourists in Venezuela, you were a step up from that, but let's say you were on the streets, you were bringing people, tourists around. And now tell me about the day that you got your own, if you like, as North Carolina's Businesswoman of the Year. How does that come about? Who gives it to you? Who do you have to kill to get it?
Let's not talk about the buddies in the backyard. Okay. Yes. You know, just knowing my journey to have been able to get to this place where someone nominated me. That's how it works. Somebody nominates you for the North Carolina Women Business Owners Hall of Fame. And this is a nonprofit organization that it sits in Raleigh, North Carolina. And people submit nominations for women in business in different categories for different backgrounds and whatnot. And then the selection committee that they have, they go to task and they research. They research the person. They verify that this person indeed has roots in the state, because that is one of the components of becoming a Hall of Fame. what kind of impact has this individual have in the state of North Carolina in the business community? And so I was the president of the National Association of Women Business Owners for the Charlotte chapter. I have been a board member of various organizations in the city of Charlotte. And I have also mentored, you know, startup individuals through the city of Charlotte. They have sort of classes that they give to prepare people to become business owners. And I am one of their mentors. And so that, along with the success of my firm that I started with Solopreneur just by myself, and now I have a team of seven, just build up my credibility.
Very good. And you mentioned to me before the show started that you have I wouldn't say unusual structure, but your team isn't there necessarily just to support you. Your approach has been different in growing your team. Tell me about that.
Yes. And it does come, you know, from my days as a controller in the software company, because I, you know, while I was the controller, I was also the go-to person for the developing team, the developers, to figure out what works best for our users. You know, how would you, you know, see it if we put this icon here or that thing there? Like, how does it feel in the flow, whatever? Mm-hmm. And so I was working with the different departments in that role. So when I started to hire, I decided that instead of me hiring, well, this person is going to work for me and under me, that this person was going to be my team member. And together we were going to start building something. And that's the approach is we work as a team. Our clients get to experience all of our team members, not just one person assigned to them. Mm-hmm. So that approach allows us to get to know the client better and to be able to service them. If somebody's on vacation, if somebody, you know, is not available, not a problem. Mm-hmm. Anybody can step in and take care of the client.
Interesting. So, I mean, that's a good business strategy for retention as well, right? So you have multiple points of contact and, you know, it makes the relationship stronger. And I've seen people use that where sometimes you have like a champion in a business and you're just dealing with them, then the champion leaves and what are you going to do? So if you can get like three or four points of contact, there you are. Now you're secure in there, you know, and it's a great idea.
We have a retention rate for our clients that is over 90%.
Fantastic.
Our clients stay with us for years.
Okay, very good. 90% of your clients stay with you every week or every 10 years?
Year.
10
yeah,
years.
Yeah, we have clients for 12 years.
Yeah. You can have an hourly retention rate. Everyone still leaves by Thursday. So it depends. okay, this has been a lot of fun. So tell me, who, Carolina, should reach out to you and how can they do it?
Yeah, absolutely. So Carolina can be reached through either carolinaaponte.com. That's my personal website. Mm-hmm. Or at the Carolina Aponte Instagram account or in LinkedIn. Just type in my name and I'll show up. You can also reach me through the Break Even Better podcast. We are a weekly business podcast of three distinct women business owners in different industries. Mm-hmm. And we bring real, raw, and unfiltered stories of running a business. Not just here's how you become a millionaire, but here's what really happens when you hire the wrong person and ish goes sideways.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Well, thank you very much, Carolina. I think I normally at this stage, what I do is I do a little promo for my outro. And I have to mention, I think the mastermind is the obvious one for this one, because Carolina has been a loyal attendee a couple of times now. And I've received feedback from other attendees on Carolina's contribution in the mastermind. And if you're wondering what that is, it's a 1 hour. I run a tight ship, no messing around. We come in, we put you in a group with three or four of your peers. So this is other fractional CFOs, could be a couple of years ahead of you or a couple of years behind you. and you get to brainstorm a business issue, a live issue that you're working on in confidence and get practical feedback and advice. So if that sounds like your bag, go to procurementexpress.com/mastermind, or actually you can sign up on our new website, grossprofitpodcast.com, where we have an events section, and you can sign up there. And that's your special reward for getting this far into the podcast. Thank you very much. Thank you, Carolina. This has been a really enjoyable conversation.
Thank you, James. This was great. And your mastermind has been a great experience. So I highly recommend it.